It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Ricker.
And I'm Judith Sears Poisson. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, issues like school funding and Wisconsin's teacher shortage are on the agenda for next week's National Education Association meeting in Washington, D.C. We'll find out more.
First, Democrats held the House floor for almost 26 hours overnight to protest congressional inaction on gun control laws.
Led by civil rights activist and Georgia Congressman John Lewis, Democrats staged a sit-in calling for votes on gun control measures before the House tackled any other business.
In response, Republicans adjourned the House early for the July 4th recess.
Joining us now is Isaac DeVere, senior White House reporter for Politico. Isaac, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, it's great to be here.
So Democrats ended their 26-hour sit-in earlier today. Can you describe the scene on the House floor yesterday and into this morning?
Well, I was not there into this morning, I will tell you, but I was there yesterday. It was not quite like anything that I or people who've been covering Congress for a lot longer than I have ever seen. You had the chamber, not black, but the main lights were dimmed, and the microphones were off because the chamber is officially out of session. Mm-hmm. But you had most, if not all, of the Democratic members of the House there, with Democratic senators jumping in, talking about gun control and gun violence and the need to do something. And many of them were seated on the floor in a literal sit-in. They were, you know, as a number of people have noticed already, their C-SPAN cameras were not allowed to be on because they're under the control of the majority of the chamber. So those were off, but you had this very weird situation where, because the rules of the House are that members themselves can have cell phones on the floor, they were using Periscope and other social media to just live stream the entire thing. Then that got picked up by C-SPAN. But so you had around sort of the well of the House where you had all the people who were speaking one by one, and then in front of them people seated on the floor, and then behind them a collection of people who were in charge of doing the cell phone camera work, and then other people scattered about.
So let's actually take just one step back, and how did they all end up on the floor? Who kind of gave that call to action, and was it spontaneous, or did you have the sense that this had been planned?
This had been planned. It obviously hadn't been planned for weeks and weeks. This was something that came about after the Senate filibuster last week, which itself only had a couple of days of planning. Since that Orlando shooting, it's hard to even conceive of it at this point. That was just a week and a half ago. So all of this stuff has happened very quickly. But there was a degree of planning here. I wouldn't say it was the most carefully planned thing ever, but for people to think that this wasn't carefully orchestrated and that there wasn't a lot of effort going on behind the scenes to get things going the way that they did, you'd be missing what actually went on here.
So what specific bills did Democrats want to see passed before the recess?
So the main thing that they were pushing for is this change to the law that would mean that if you're on the terrorist no-fly list, then you would not be allowed to buy a gun. That is a provision that the president is behind, that the Senate's behind, and that public polling shows that most people are behind by overwhelming numbers, but the Republicans in the House and Senate have been unable to find a way to move on that.
So House Speaker Paul Ryan responded to the sit-in. Let's hear what he had to say.
This is nothing more than a publicity stunt. That's point number one. Point number two is this bill was already defeated in the United States Senate. Number three, we are not going to take away a citizen's due process rights. We're not going to take away a citizen's constitutional rights without due process. That was already defeated in the Senate, and this is not a way to try and bring up legislation.
House Speaker Paul Ryan, they're calling the Democratic sit-in a publicity stunt. Besides characterizing it that way, what measures are Republicans advancing, if any, on gun control?
So now nothing. That was the whole point of what was going on here. There is movement in the Senate, a bill being put forward by Susan Collins, a senator from Maine, but in the House, there is not movement.
We're talking with Isaac DeVere, senior White House reporter for Politico, and we're taking a look at the Democratic sit-in in Congress yesterday in the House of Representatives looking for action on gun control legislation. So as you said earlier, Republicans adjourned the House early, turned off the video cameras on the floor, but the Democrats did continue to broadcast their protest via social media, getting picked up on C-SPAN, even though the C-SPAN cameras were not on. In taking this, as you described it too, this dramatic action and this unusual move, Democrats seem to be emboldened by a shift in public sentiment in the wake of the Orlando shootings. Do you have a sense if the public is responding one way or another to this particular effort, in this very in-your-face kind of effort on the part of the Democrats?
Well, I'm not sure I understand exactly the question. So,
well, how is the public responding?
So you have right now there was a lot of support from people who were showing up at the Capitol building last night and even into the House gallery into late at night. It did obviously break through in a lot of ways. People were talking about it all over the country. You guys were talking about it. And so there is attention to this issue in a way that there hadn't been. But what that adds up to long term is unclear at this point. This is an issue that probably doesn't move unless there are significant changes in the makeup of the House and Senate come the November election.
We are talking about the sit-in on the floor of the House of Representatives yesterday, and we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Do you agree with House Speaker Paul Ryan that this is just a publicity stunt and not a way to try and bring up legislation? Or do you think the Democrats are responding to frustration in their party and perhaps in the general public about a lack of movement on gun control? That number is 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page or email us at talk@wpr.org. So Paul Ryan mentioned that there have been other gun control efforts by the Democrats recently, including that filibuster by Chris Murphy of Connecticut in the Senate, but that still ended up in gridlock. Is this a topic, as you've been following the movement or lack of movement on various pieces of legislation in Washington, that is this one of those that nothing is going to happen because there's such a polarized sense between the two parties?
Well, one of the things that we've seen that is demonstrative of the change is that you had almost all the Democrats there on the House floor for gun control. A couple of years ago, even, there were Democrats who would not have been willing to stand for measures that were opposed by the NRA and would not have agreed with the leadership of their party on this. But you see a coalescing within the Democratic Party about the where gun control issue is for them, and you see that same coalescing going on within the Republican Party. So, given that, it is hard to say that the politics on this haven't changed, but the practical reality of what happens going forward from that doesn't seem to be in real. There doesn't seem to be a real chance of it changing, unless there are people who win or lose elections based on their positions on gun control.
Some have said that this is sort of a crossing of the Rubicon, that it changes the game of how Republicans and Democrats interact from now on between the filibuster and now the sit-in. Is this really a game changer, and what does it mean?
I think we're well past the point where people are doing stunts in politics, and Republicans themselves, who are the ones leading the charge, complaining about this being a stunt, could be fairly pointed out, shut down the government in 2013 for what was a stunt. It did not lead to any change in things, and it was about trying to get President Obama essentially to gut Obamacare in a way that everybody knew wasn't going to happen. And that led to several weeks of the government being shut down and people losing wages and all sorts of political drama around it. But that was something that was just part of the political process in some people's
lives. Let's take a quick call from Marianne in Sturgeon Bay. Hi, Marianne.
Hello. Well, number one, I think that the Democrats are absolutely right and appropriate in taking the action they did. They're reflecting what the majority in this country is desiring. And I think the poll was something like 72 or 71% of the American public wants something done with regard to guns. This is a start. This has nothing to do with terrorism. What they're reflecting, terrorism is certainly a part of it, but we're reflecting the fact that we are a gun society and that we have the highest rate of casualties and murders in this country as a result of guns.
And I just want to give Isaac a chance in the last 20 seconds or so. The Congress will be back again soon after the 4th of July. What's the next step?
Well, at this point, it's in the Democrats' hands to see if they will figure out some other way to push this issue. The thing about doing a sit-in like this is that it worked when you have the element of surprise. It won't be so easy for them to pull it off quite like this again.
Isaac, thanks so much for joining us today. That was Isaac DeVere, senior White House reporter for Politico.
The National Education Association is holding its annual meeting next week in Washington, D.C.
Among the Wisconsinites attending is the new president of the Wisconsin Education Association Council, Ron Martin. He says Wisconsin attendees have a lot to talk about, including school funding and Wisconsin's teacher shortage.
Ron Martin joins us now, along with his new role as president of WEAC. He's a middle school social studies teacher in Eau Claire and the former president of the Eau Claire Association of Educators. Ron, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thanks. Thanks for having me.
Next week, the National Education Association holds its annual meeting in Washington, D.C. And as the new president of the Wisconsin Education Association Council, what's on the top of your list of issues facing educators here in Wisconsin?
Well, we have several issues that are facing educators in Wisconsin, but one of them that I think is going to be important for us to address statewide will be teacher retention and attraction. So either way you want to look at it, the attraction, encouraging people to go into the teaching profession, and then once we get them in, how do we keep them? So those are some of the issues that we're going to be addressing for the coming year and looking forward to that.
So how dire or concerning would you say the situation is for the numbers of teachers in Wisconsin right now?
I think it's very concerning, and I've always been an individual that, we have to be prepared. So perhaps in some areas of the state it's not as dire as other parts, but as we're taking a look at the number of students or individuals who are going into education programs, that number has dropped dramatically in our UW system and our private colleges. So we know that we're going to have a large number of retirees in the next several years as the baby boomers look to their next career in life, which is retirement. We have to replace those individuals. And it's not looking like we're going to have enough individuals to replace. So it is dire for me.
What have you been hearing about the numbers of young people who are choosing to go into the teaching profession in Wisconsin?
Well, what we're hearing from the UW system particularly is that they have less students enrolling in the program or applying for program. So that's pretty concerning. I mean, they have students that are saying, I want to be a teacher, but then they're never actually going through the application process to get into program. And so that is concerning, and we're working with our UW system, with the schools of education, to figure out ways in which we can help solve that problem.
Do you know why young people may not be choosing teaching in Wisconsin or elsewhere?
Well, it's only a speculative on my part, but I think some of the reasons when you graduate with such high debt and the teaching profession just isn't paying, you know, they're choosing other careers to pay off that debt. I think that's one area. I think the other area is that individuals just don't want to go into a profession that is not respected, that is not revered as an admirable profession. And I think that that has a lot to do with it. I think people look at that and they say, oh, I want to stay away from teaching, and I'll become a lawyer, or I'll become an HR manager. But teaching, I just see what's happening to teachers in the state of Wisconsin, and I don't want to put myself there.
Ron, do you think it's just the state of Wisconsin, or do you think this is something that's going on nationally?
I do think it is going on nationally. I mean, the NEA predicts in the next, 5 years, or maybe 10 years, it'll be like a 2.5 million retirement or people leaving the profession that we're going to have to fill. And so I think it is going on nationally.
What about the respect aspect of it? You said in Wisconsin, teachers aren't respected. Do you see that happening elsewhere?
You know what? I do see it elsewhere. I see as certain attacks happen throughout the nation on different education organizations. But, you know, we can look to our neighbors to the west of us in Minnesota, and it's a very different picture. I have a lot of friends who teach in Minnesota. I teach in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, which isn't that far from the border there. And it's just a whole different world. I know several of my friends who left the Eau Claire Area School District to teach in Minnesota. And, you know, they have the choice, and they chose Minnesota, leaving 4 or 5 years of teaching in Eau Claire. So, you know, I do see it's happening nationwide, but there are pockets where it's not happening, and those are the states we have to learn from.
Now, the Wisconsin Education Association Council says the state, Wisconsin, has a broken funding formula. What's at stake there with school funding in Wisconsin?
Well, I don't think we're the only ones saying that. I think taxpayers, the voters in the last round of elections said it as well when they passed so many referendums around the state to fund their public schools. I think they're saying something's broken, something's not right. And so I would say that we're saying it, now community members are saying it, voters are saying it. It is not a good system right now. And I think Tony Evers has presented twice plans to help fix the funding. So I think that's one of the areas. The other areas, we're now venturing into this area where we're trying to fund two education systems in Wisconsin, the pre-K-12 public education and then the voucher school education. And I think that's really dangerous because we're taking money away from the largest population and taking it to the smallest. And it's hurting some of our rural school districts. It's hurting some of our suburban school districts as well as our urban. So all around, we need to fix it.
So if you were writing the law, if WEAC was writing the law, what would you want to see changed with school funding in Wisconsin?
You know, I want to take a look at the plan that was last presented by Tony Evers and take a look at that fair funding. I know that it needs to be tweaked, but I think that that's a starting point, and I think that's where we can begin with some law that will help make it more equitable and so that our distribution of funds throughout the state is not contingent upon, you know, taxpayers' wealth and, you know, property tax and the areas like Hayward, et cetera, that are, large areas for resorts and vacation. We just really have to look at that. So I think that's a starting point, and that's where I'd start.
We're talking with Ron Martin right now. He's the president-elect of the Wisconsin Education Association Council. And Ron, a new study from the conservative group, the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty, took a look at the education landscape in Wisconsin 5 years after Act 10. And what they say is that they found no significant change in the number of students per teacher after Act 10, no significant change in school district spending on teacher gross salaries, although they did say they found a difference in base salaries. But in short, they summarize it and they say critics of Act 10 then and now have claimed that Wisconsin teachers, that this Act 10 would destroy the teaching profession. And the report shows that some of these claims were exaggerated or have not materialized. What is your response to that?
Well, first of all, it's really concerning to me that we have a report that, you know, in my view is just more propaganda that's being bought and paid for by the same groups that pushed nearly $1 billion in cuts to our neighborhood public schools over the past 5 years. So I'm suspect of where the study is coming from, who is conducting the study. But most important to me is, it's taking some data and trying to analyze that data and then giving an analysis. It's not asking the individuals who are out there working every day with our kids. It's not asking the community members how they feel. It's not asking our educators how they feel. That part is absent. And I think a real different picture would show up if they interviewed and talked to educators throughout the state as well as parents, because it is very different working in public schools now than pre-Act 10.
Well, what do you see as an impact? It sounds as though you do see one. How would you describe the impact 5 years after Act 10?
Well, there's several. I know we don't have a lot of time to go through all of them, but some of the real simple ones, or not simple, but some of the ones that are real obvious, are the hard-to-staff areas or hard to attract teachers to because they're not able to provide a competitive salary. So it's kind of a trading game going out there. So we have one school district that's able to pay this much more and will essentially take a teacher away because they're able to pay them more, and then that district isn't able to pay them more. That's real dangerous, and I think that that's what's been created in our state. That's one area. We do see class sizes that are much larger, and I know to parents, it's really important that their child get individual one-to-one attention, and we're talking particularly in the elementary or in the areas of special ed. We see a large number of classes, and school districts are having to be forced to choose between this and that because they're not being properly funded. So I think there are some significant areas that we have to address.
Ron, thank you so much for joining us.
I really appreciate it. Thank you for having me.
Ron Martin is the president-elect of the Wisconsin Education Association Council. He's a middle school social studies teacher in Eau Claire and the former president of the Eau Claire Association of Educators. And he joined us to talk about next week's agenda for WEAC at the National Education Association's annual meeting in Washington, D.C.
One of the cherished stories about the founding of the United States is the belief that the country would be a class-free society where anyone could rise above their circumstances through a combination of hard work and perseverance. But our next guest says it wasn't true then, and it's still not true today. Discussions of class and the 1% have been at the center of political debates leading up to the presidential election in November. She says these conversations often ignore the long history in our country of privilege and class divide.
Nancy Eisenberg joins us now. She's a professor of American history at Louisiana State University and the author of the new book, White Trash, the 400-year untold history of class in America. Nancy, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, how are you?
Doing well, thanks. Well, you say that throughout its history, America has always had a class system. And, you know, like we just heard, this is not the narrative that most of us grow up hearing about our country. It's the foundational story that there are no classes and anybody can move up. Why do you disagree with that?
Well, I disagree because the facts just don't back it up. The reason we have that myth is it goes back to the idea. This is ideas that can be traced back to Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, Tom Paine, but they all argued that because the United States was going to expand westward and fill this large continent, that magically would solve class competition. This is particularly the ideas of Benjamin Franklin. Franklin argued that if people, particularly poor people, were pushed into the West or migrated into the West, that essentially that would flatten out the class system and create what he called a happy mediocrity. But this was an old theory, a theory he got from the British, because one of the points that I make from the very beginning, the British, when they thought about what North America would be used for, would be a place for dumping the poor. And this was carried on by Franklin and Jefferson and others who, and this idea later develops into the safety valve theory, that somehow the poor can be released into the West, and somehow, if they make it there, then they can rise up the class ladder. But the fact is, what that really offers is horizontal mobility, not upward mobility. And as poor people did actually move into the back country or the old Northwest during the early Republic and the early antebellum period, what we found is that they were dismissed as squatters and crackers. They were called by Jefferson trespassers. and they were associated with the landless. And they weren't given any advantages as they moved west because large land speculators, large landholders had better connection to the land office and also ended up getting the best land. So the class system was just replicated as people moved west. So that's one of my big points, is that we have confused horizontal mobility for upward mobility.
And before we go too much farther, I want to talk about the term itself, the title of your book, White Trash. I mean, it is a loaded term in a lot of ways. What are you trying to get at by using that term?
Well, the actual term white trash, as people who've tried to study when it first was used in newspapers, is in the 1820s. But it has a much older history. And as I alluded to in the first answer, we did not escape British thinking about poverty or class after the American Revolution. And that's another myth. We assume that we broke free and we created a brand new nation. In fact, what the British thought of, as I mentioned, about dumping the poor into the new world, they referred to them as waste people. Now, where did that idea come from? Well, we forget that America, as Great Britain, celebrated the idea of an agrarian economy, and we've been an agrarian nation for over half of our history. So what was the measure of civic worth and value was the land and property. What was the word that was used to describe worthless land, swampy land, scrubby land, unfallow land that was left fallow, wasteland? So this is another point that I try to emphasize, is that throughout our history, there's been an intimate connection, both politically, metaphorically, between how we think about class, how we think about who's valuable in society, and its connections to land and property ownership. And that's still with us today, because we still look at owning a home as an important measure of being in the middle class.
So when you talk about this using of the new world as sort of a dumping ground for the poor, is that something that the founding figures of our country were complicit in, or did they just sort of inherit it and try to rid themselves of it but just not do it very well? How involved were they?
Well, you have to imagine that the founders started out being British subjects. They also very much believed in British ideas. Franklin was one of the first advocates of demography, political arithmetic, and they all subscribed to this idea that a nation's strength was in its numbers. So they embraced certain English ideas. As far as the poor goes, and the founders sort of engaged in two different strategies. Sometimes they would ignore the poor, as Tom Paine does. Sometimes they would attack the poor, as Franklin does. I mean, he would write scathing newspaper pieces attacking the poor moving into Philadelphia or Pennsylvania, attacking convict labor. You have to realize that most Americans at the time of the American Revolution would fall into the category of being unfree. That means not only slave labor, but apprentices. Franklin himself was a runaway apprentice, a runaway servant. We also had high numbers of convict laborers. So to sort of say that they weren't aware of this, they were completely aware of it. And these patterns of how poor laborers were used, was a part of the colonial inheritance. And what I'm trying to suggest is that even though they were aware of this, they realized that they were going to apply the same basic solution. The key was pushing the poor somewhere else, dumping them in the frontier. This is a prevalent idea. This is an idea that we also still have today. If you think about urban renewal, and this is one of the issues that I'm raising, is that class has a geography. And we still adhere, if you live in a good neighborhood and you have all the amenities, a good grocery store, a good school, you have a clear class advantage over someone who's not only, as I highlight, not only if we think about poor black urban areas, but in the case of poor whites, one of the major areas of poverty that would develop in the post-World War II area were called hillbilly havens. And these were the sites of trailer parks. And it's really symbolic that the trailer, or trailer trash, is associated with the other group that the English hated, which were vagrants. The mobile poor. And if you think about a trailer, what's a trailer? It's a home with wheels.
We're talking right now with Nancy Eisenberg. She's the T. Harry Williams Professor of American History at Louisiana State University, and she's the author of the new book called White Trash, The 400-Year Untold History of Class in America. And Nancy, you write about contempt for the poor. What would the beginning of that history be, and where do you think it is today?
I show there are moments where there are attempts to tell a more populist story about the poor. In the antebellum period, this is usually sort of associated with what's known as the common man and the way Jackson was able to appeal to the common man. And I highlight a very popular story about Shug the squatter, which makes him far less dangerous and volatile, which is how most people wrote about squatters. They would actually physically chase people off the land that they had title to if they felt they had an earlier claim to it. So you do have these populist moments, but they're usually outweighed by the negative, really, really negative views. And the other theme I highlight is that what we also inherited from the British was an emphasis on pedigree, lineage. And you find by the antebellum period, by 1860, there is an emphasis, the same way people were talking about race, but an emphasis is class as something that was inherited. And that if you were a poor white, or if you were white trash, essentially your class status was seen as something that was in the blood, something that was congenital, something that was passed down through generations. And this is something that we find surprising, but it makes perfect sense if we think about how popular the eugenics movement was in the United States. The eugenics movement was a widespread movement embraced by academics, embraced by politicians. There were numerous states that passed sterilization laws in this country, and we forget that what is eugenics based on? But it was based on this idea that certain people should not be allowed to reproduce. Their bloodline should be cut. And, of course, who were the people who were targeted for sterilization? The largest group would be poor white women. And, in fact, in the very famous Supreme Court case of Buck v. Bell, the woman who was focused on as the litigant in that case was a poor white woman who was selected. She was selected for sterilization in Virginia because she was seen as one of the, quote, shiftless, ignorant, and worthless class of antisocial whites of the South.
We're talking with Nancy Eisenberg right now. She's the author of the book White Trash, The 400-Year Untold History of Class in America.
And we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. What do you think gets missed in conversations about class divisions in the United States? How do you think class is playing out in the presidential election so far? And what do you think needs to change to help bridge some of the class divides in our nation? Call in at 800-642-1234. You can also post your thoughts on our Facebook page.
Right now, we're continuing our conversation about the history of class division in the United States with Nancy Eisenberg. She's the T. Harry Williams Professor of American History at Louisiana State University and the author of the book White Trash, The 400-Year Untold History of Class in America.
And we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. We want to know what you think about the role of class divisions in the current presidential election. What do you think about the term white trash? If you consider yourself to be blue collar or part of the working class, do you think we're honest about class divisions in America? Call now at 800-642-1234. You can also post what you think on the Central Time Facebook page.
And Nancy, in your book, you cover a big sweep of history. You've got the Civil Rights era, you've got the Civil War, and onward from there. But I want to touch now on culture and how poor people have been portrayed in popular culture. And here's a clip from the Beverly Hillbillies.
What is your name?
Jed Clampett, ma'am, and this here's...
And you expect me to believe that you have $25 million?
Well, no, not on me, ma'am, but my neighbor, Mr. Drysdale, he's keeping it in his bank for me.
So in a way, is that a celebration of poor people? Is that a celebration the same way maybe the Dukes of Hazzard was? How do you read that?
Well, it's funny. The actual show's producer believed that the Beverly Hillbillies was going to change perceptions of Appalachian poor whites, rural whites. But it's not true at all, because in fact, as other newspaper commentators pointed out, part of the anxiety that's played out in the Beverly Hillbillies, this was a Chicago writer, Paul Harvey, he said that in 1968, he said, suppose a real-life likeness of TV's Beverly Hillbillies should move to the big city without those millions of dollars in the bank. And the reason he said that is this is a part of history we completely ignore. We know about poor blacks and who move and migrate in the north, but there also was a mass migration of poor whites who created what were known as hillbilly ghettos in cities such as Baltimore, St. Louis, Detroit, Chicago, and Cincinnati. So, no, and the other thing that was highlighted in the Beverly Hillbillies, it sort of shows how they can't deal with modern technology. And that even goes back to the allusions to the 1930s. Even the truck that Beverly Hillbillies drove in looked like the Jodes truck. So it has sort of overtones to the, you know, they were referred to in the 30s as squatters on wheels. So, no, I don't think you can actually see the Beverly Hillbillies as a celebration of class diversity. And another writer at the time who wrote for the Los Angeles Times felt that this is really an effort of Americans to celebrate their class consciousness and also to use humor to camouflage class conflict, because he highlighted that every show was about, you know, was a battle between the slobs and the snobs. In that clip you ran, it talked about the banker, Milburn Drysdale, and he's always made to look foolish. The Clampets are made to look foolish. And it was a part to sort of, as this writer said, to make the people in the middle, average viewers, feel superior to both people at the top, people at the bottom. So I think that we know, and this is one of the things I highlight, we talk about how poor whites have been such an important part, not only in our economy, not only in part of the way the class structure operates, but also part of our, you know, political imagination, because it taps into that anxiety that what it proves is that, yeah, you can have a lot of bucks in the case of the Clampets, but they don't, in terms of their social breeding, their behavior, they don't move one step up the social ladder.
Let's get to our callers now. We've got Bob on the line first in Milwaukee. Hi, Bob.
Hey, thanks for taking the call. I have to comment. I turned you guys on and started listening. I'm just chuckling, shaking my head, because I grew up, and when I say poor, dirt poor, in a super wealthy area, and had to kind of nurse myself along and pretend that I fit in. And growing up, you know, going to country clubs, dragged along to country clubs and exclusive resorts and those type of operations, but going home and really knowing that I had, you know, I came from nowhere with nothing, but I lived with a group of people that were bathed in wealth, and I'm not exaggerating. So I always kind of lived the mantra, too smart for NASCAR, too dumb for opera. That was kind of how I grew up, and no regrets, but it's true. People would ask, you know, where I came from and what was my background, and I kind of had to improvise and limp along in that environment.
And Bob, just really briefly, and we've got other callers, but did you feel like you were able to, you know, rise above your circumstances, or do you think there is something that tethers you to wherever you were born, whatever class?
My mother's parents were tea-drinking Methodist, really strict, and my father's background was partying, hard-drinking lifestyle. And I just think it was an interesting way to grow up, and I have no regrets. Obviously, I couldn't control that, but I'm glad I grew up where I did, because I see both sides of it, and I kind of fell in the middle. I got an education and bettered myself.
Bob, thank you so much. I really appreciate you calling and sharing some of your story with us. And Nancy, just briefly so we can get to some other callers, what do you hear when you hear Bob's story?
Yeah, I think he's making a really good point. It's a point that I try to stress in this book, that class has never been simply about wealth and occupation. It's about pedigree and breeding. We still measure class today by how a person dresses, how they talk, their education level, their expressions of taste. And that's what the person who called in was highlighting. And I think one of the interesting things about being in the middle class is the idea that you're supposed to assimilate into the middle class, somehow remove those traces if you come from a working class or a rural background. And I highlight this when I'm talking about, you know, Lyndon Johnson, that there's always that fear when I talk about the way in which people talk about the country boy. There's always a fear that somehow you'll say something inappropriate. You won't be able to conceal your artless drawl or dust the sticky red clay, that the indelible marks of class are forever there. And I think that even someone who does move into the middle class, they're very aware, as the caller was, that they don't feel like they quite belong. And it's very similar in a lot of ways to the way in which people who are black and who pass for white, that idea that you have to disguise who you really are in order to fit in.
Well, thanks again for that call, and we're going to go next to Jerry in Milwaukee. Hi, Jerry. Jerry, you with us? Nope, let's go to line three. We've got Marcus in Green Bay. Marcus, hi.
Hi. I just wondered if you guys ever heard of a phrase called white trash TV, and it has to do nothing with race or anything. It's just the shows, the programs that are available, but it's mostly what I mean by that is the ads that are targeted towards viewers, such as myself. I'm a low-income person. I have antenna TV, and then throughout the day and especially late at night, I'm talking mostly about the ads and how they target people of low income and who may not be educated and stuff. I'm a muter, so I don't listen to the ads. But have you heard?
Marcus, I think we are getting your gist there. And so, Nancy, you do get into television programs and what Marcus called their white trash TV, he says.
Yeah, I mean, reality TV is not reality. It's scripted. There's different shows. Different shows appeal to different things. There's the voyeurism of Honey Boo Boo, but there's also in the Duck Dynasty, which has more similarities with the Beverly Hillbillies and is this also this vaudeville tradition that even predated the Beverly Hillbillies. That's where Hee Haw came from, where you had this idea that, you know, it's sort of the slapstick hillbilly. So you have both of these traditions that are important, and I think what the caller was highlighting is the advertising. And this is something that we know. Advertising in the 20th century studied people's buying behavior. And I read this wonderful article that was published in, I think, 1915. And it had broken down all the classes and all the differences in terms of what their tastes were, like wine versus whiskey versus beer and everything. So, yes, clearly shows, because that's why TV was even invented or why radio was invented, was for advertising. They're very conscious of marketing class tastes.
And we leave it there. Nancy, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
That was Nancy Eisenberg. She's the T. Harry Williams Professor of American History at Louisiana State University and the author of the new book called White Trash, the 400-year untold history of class in America. And you can find more information about her new book on the Central Time Facebook page. You could also share your story while you're there. Just search Central Time on WPR to find us. Today, citizens of Great Britain are voting on whether to stay part of the European Union or not. The two sides have been dubbed Brexit and Remain.
And a British tweeter continued that wordplay by speculating what other EU member nations' exit campaigns would be called. He came up with Departigal, Italeave, Checkout, Austria, Finnish, Slovakout, Latervia, and Bijum.
Others got into the act and added quiddly, retire land, pull out, Bipris, check please, nether again, Ditchland, and with a nod to Schwarzenegger, Austria Vista, baby.
Sweden, though, might win for the most plays on its name. Folks came up with Swegon, Swexile, and Swedulator.
Well, whichever way the vote goes, the founding tweet's been shared at this point over 6,000 times already.
And as votes continue to be tallied across the pond, we'll leave you with this from The Clash.
Darling, you got to let me know. Should I stay or should I go? If you say that you are mine, I'll be here till the end of time. So you've got to let me know. Should I stay or should I go? It's always tease, tease.